this recording on the teachings of Science and Health's first chapter prayer, made by Gordon Brown in 1988, is not designed to take the place of the prayer tape made in 1969, which is tape number 2 in his series on the textbook's complete range of chapters. The reason for this recording is on account of the new light regarding this chapter that has consistently dawned since the first tape was made. This tape, therefore, is available to help the student penetrate more deeply into the teachings of this particular chapter, should he feel led to do so. It has been made following a further study of the chapter in company with another group of students. As before, the listener is asked to have a copy of the textbook open in front of him so that he can follow what is being said paragraph by paragraph, page by page.
Well, we've had quite a glorious time, haven't we? A spiritually fruitful and inspiring time pondering these 17 pages of the first chapter prayer, and basing our thought all the way through on the capitalized synonymous terms for God. Because, of course, our only purpose in this work is to culture ever more deeply an understanding of the allness of God on the one hand and the nothingness of everything that's the opposite of God on the other. What we're doing, therefore, fundamentally is observing and pondering the use in the text of these terms. Not selectively out of context, but in the order in which they unfold in the text itself. Basically, the seven of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love, which teach us what God is constitutionally, as it were, and the four of the Word, Christ, Christianity, science, which teach us about the integrated operational flow of what God is as comprising our own being and that of our universe. And so, having encompassed the 17 pages in this way, the time has come, we've decided, for us to try to gather up as coherently as we can the essentials of what the text has been saying to us, in order to consolidate a little the teachings of the chapter as a whole, but also to feel the beauty of how this leads, virtually without a break, to the second chapter, Atonement and Eucharist. Because this is the way it's going to be from chapter to chapter throughout all the chapters of the book. But before we begin this spiritual epitome, if we can call it that, we're going to remind ourselves of a very remarkable and exciting discovery regarding the textbook as a whole, which has only really brought itself to light in comparatively recent years. It's this. We know, don't we, that as we glance down Science and Health's contents page, that the book itself is made up altogether of 18 chapters, and that it's the first 16 of these, from prayer to the apocalypse, that comprise the main body of the book. Not that we ever disregard the last two chapters, glossary and fruitage, but our need is to understand them, of course, in relation to the first 16, and therefore in relation to the book as a whole. 16, then. That's 4 multiplied by 4, isn't it? Or 4 squared, in accord with the symbol of the holy 4-square city that appears at the end of the book of Revelation. And which signifies, don't forget, the goal towards which civilized humanity has consistently been moving, spiritually as well as historically, ever since the beginnings of our present civilization movement. The word city has basically the same signification as the word civilization, hasn't it? Very important, that. Well, the wonderful thing is that the 16th and last of this four-square structure of the chapters, the Apocalypse, beginning page 558, is itself composed of precisely 16 sections of text. And we can verify this quite quickly by just flicking through the pages from 558 to 578, and including the interpretation of the 23rd Psalm at the end, count up the number of verses from Revelation 10, Revelation 12, and Revelation 21 that are under discussion in this particular chapter. And there are exactly 15 of them, to which, when we add the treatise on the 23rd Psalm, brings the total up to the four square number of 16. Now the glorious realization that has today irrefutably revealed itself is that these 16 sections of the Apocalypse chapter unfold in precise correlation, one by one, with the teachings and meanings of the first 16 chapters themselves. And therefore, it becomes very illuminating, very inspiring, and very helpful today to follow the 16 chapters and the 16 sections as they develop in parallel, the one with the other. So what we're going to do before turning in detail to the opening chapter prayer is to see what the opening section of the Apocalypse is telling us, so that we can bear this in mind all the time we are examining the teachings of the chapter itself. Now, shall we do that? Well, first then, the Apocalypse section 1, and this is pages 558 and 559. Now, what's it all about? It's about, isn't it, the descent from heaven in the hands of a mighty angel of the little open book, Science and Health, containing, it said, the revelation of divine science. And remember, it's the book as a whole, not just its first chapter, which we're being told about, and which we are bidden to eat up, to ponder, to assimilate, from beginning to end. And it's our purpose, of course, to do just this, isn't it, as we embark on the study one by one of all 18 chapters of the book, to digest, to understand, to gradually make our own subjectively what it is these chapters are teaching us. And therefore the great foundational underlying principle elucidated in the first chapter prayer is that which applies necessarily chapter by chapter throughout the entire four-square structure until we reach at last the 23rd Psalm, the 16th section of the 16th chapter correlative with the 16th chapter itself, where we find ourselves dwelling in the house, the consciousness of love forever, and where we no longer have any want. Divine love is my shepherd, I shall not want. And why don't I want anymore? Because at this point I am. The kingdom of God is reflected within me in all its fullness, in all its health, in all its wholeness, and therefore in its totally satisfying completeness. And therefore that original sense of desire, which is basic, isn't it, to the first chapter prayer, comes right the way through to the chapter of the Apocalypse, or to the solving of this most fundamental of all human problems, the apparent want on our part to possess personally that which we believe is external to us over there. All envy, jealousy, greed, and so on, having yielded at that point to the true sense of love. And we are free from all carnal wants and desires. What a thought! So on page 558, the little book comes down from God out of heaven, doesn't it? Just like the City Four Square itself does in the closing sections of the chapter. That's over on 575 and 577. And at first, it seems to be clothed with a cloud. That is, its meaning initially seems obscure, yet a bright promise, a bright seven-hued rainbow of promise crowns its brow. The prism of divine science, in other words, analyzes what we might call the white light of God, furnishing us with the complete spectrum of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love, whereby God is understood, and therefore the book itself is understood. Well, the angel's face, we are told, is the sun. If there wasn't any sun, there wouldn't be any rainbow, would there? So when we come face to face with the book's divine principle, when we commune with this principle direct, as we are taught to do specifically in the first chapter prayer, so that there's nothing in between us and it, this is what heals. And its healing power lies in its 2 feet, or in its 2 foundational pillars of truth and love. Remember that, its foundations of truth and love, there on 558.17. Which act, we see, like the fiery baptism of the Holy Ghost, like it did on the day of Pentecost, when cloven tongues of fire lighted on each of Jesus' disciples, and the world as a whole represented in the second chapter, the Acts of the Apostles, you remember, by men out of every nation under heaven who were in Jerusalem at the time, responded understandingly to what the disciples were telling them. And therefore, as we read on 559, the little book, the revelation of divine science, has its right foot, its dominant power upon the sea, and its left foot, its secondary power upon the earth. Which means, says the text, that it has power over elementary latent error as the source of all error's visible forms. That's to say, it has power primarily over all belief in a latent unconscious source of error, and secondarily over belief in the conscious, tangible appearing of error itself out of this elemental source. And what, therefore, these 2 feet, these 2 error-consuming foundations of truth and love, stand for positively in science, is the fact that the real source of our being and of our world's being is God Himself, the dominant power. While the outcome of this source is man in God's image and likeness, the secondary power. And therefore, through the use of this twofold absolute power of God as source and man as God's own manifestation emanating from this source, the 7 thunders of evil, this is 559.13, the full diapason of error's secret latent tones are brought to the surface of consciousness to be proved non-existent by this all-powerful union and communion of God and man. In which case, of course, no beast from the sea and no beast from the earth is able to rise up to devastate us humanly, as they're represented as doing in Revelation 13, as the agents of so-called animal magnetism or the great red dragon. So what basically we're concerned with is simply source and output, isn't it? Both positively and negatively. Positive, revealing the negative's total unreality. Well, in order to make this wonderful revelation real to us, our need, clearly, is to take the little book. The revelation of divine science. To take it and eat it up. To study and ponder it from beginning to end. All the way, that is, from preface to fruitage, and to do this, as we shall see, precisely in accordance with the principle that is taught us in the opening chapter prayer. And as we remember that what the book is all about is the science of our man's being in all its health, or wholeness, we ought not to find its digestion, the deeply subjective, the profoundly ordered understanding of it, bitter, did we? Because what we, man, little by little, are going to find ourselves to be as the result of this study is none other than the very body, 559.25, of the divine principle itself, the actual living embodiment of the 4-square principle of the book. And the reason for this is that, like the Israelites of old, that's line 29, we shall be partaking of the Paschal or Passover meal, and in consequence be delivered from Egypt or from the bondage of life in matter. We shall be passing over from death to life, in other words, from mortality to immortality. Or putting that more accurately, our real immortal life will be in process of passing over death. The result? Inheritance of our real God-ordained selfhood in the promised land of Christian science. Yes? Wonderful. Well, there we'll leave this little glimpse of the first section of the Apocalypse and turn to chapter 1, the prayer chapter itself, where we begin to base ourselves absolutely, as we shall see, on this very same liberating principle and the way it operates in our daily lives. So page 1 then, and those two introductory scriptural verses upon which the chapter is based. We got them. You see, however mountainous any particular error seems to us to be, what we've got to do is to cast it back into its own elemental sea. The sea we learn about in the first Apocalypse section, where it claims to have originated, or which is its source. Because this is the only way, isn't it, that we're going to establish its nothingness. If error hasn't got any source or cause, it can't possibly appear as effect, can it? And this means to say, in the Bible quote, that our Father knoweth what things we have need of before we ask him. In other words, the solution to each and every problem already is divinely before this appears to us humanly. So what we are doing spiritually, therefore, as we throw error back into the sea, is to give everything that we are back to God as the real source of our being. Do we see that? So, paragraph 1. The prayer which reforms the sinner and heals the sick is an absolute faith that all things are possible to God. All things are possible, indeed, all things are inevitable, because they already are divinely. But in order to experience them humanly, we've got to be possessed of a spiritual understanding of God and unselfed love. There's the need, that's to say, to balance the letter of spiritual understanding with the spirit of unself-love in everything we say and do. So as we examine that opening sentence, we see that really it's in three phases. Very soon we realize that these three phases make up the very simple structure of the chapter as a whole. First, what constitutes prayer itself, then what prayer does. And what it does is two things. One, it reforms the sinner, and two, it heals the sick. And therefore the wonder is that from page 1 to the top of page 5 we are instructed in the nature of the prayer itself. Then from the top of page 5 to the bottom of page 11 the way in which this reforms the sinner. While from the top of page 12 to the end of the chapter, that's page 17, how, in consequence, it heals the sick. Because even when we reach the climactic Lord's Prayer at the end of the chapter, we are told on 16, line 23, how the state of spiritual consciousness, which is the Lord's Prayer, instantaneously heals the sick. How simple and ordered it is then, isn't it, regarding the threefold pattern of the chapter? The prayer itself, reforming the sinner, healing the sick. Now, as we found, the purpose of the chapter, isn't it, is to bring us to where, at the bottom of page 14, we obey the command of Jesus and enter what is called the sanctuary of spirit, as being the very heart of prayer itself, or where we are having actual audience with spirit, the divine principle, love, which destroys all error. This ultimate entry into direct communion with God is really the key, therefore, isn't it, to the entire chapter, and the key, therefore, to our attitude regarding the whole of the book. Namely, that in our union and communion with the Father, Mother, God, we have audience with God divinely rather than the other way round, God listening to what we have to say humanly. Little by little, in other words, we culture the love to let God tell us rather than our seeming to figure things out for ourselves or our seeming to tell God. Because then it is that this secret, silent, heartfelt union with divinity outpictures itself humanly in that it rewards us openly. Jesus' own words, it's page 15, line 1, "Thy Father which seeth in secret will reward thee openly." And therefore the entire chapter, as we've found, has to do with this one great theme of the secret, open, divine, human, inner, outer, subjective, objective coincidence of God and man. So profound, and yet so profoundly simple, isn't it really? Our inside, as it were, and our outside of identically the same quality. So what we see in the opening paragraph on page 1 is that prayer, watching and working, combined with self-immolation, are not really man's means of accomplishing spirituality, but rather are God's gracious means for accomplishing whatever has been successfully done for the Christianization and health of mankind. Christianization? The reforming of the sinner, isn't it? The health of mankind? Healing the sick. What a beautiful, utterly basic opening paragraph it is then, isn't it? Everything from the beginning, wholly based on God as source, as initiator. So that the order is always from God to man, and only from man to God, inasmuch as man, as God's reflection, of necessity returns all to God, where everything comes from, and where everything receives its incentive and its initiative. So paragraph 2, where although thoughts are unspoken, and this is what the chapter demands throughout, isn't it? Inward silent prayer instead of outward audible prayer, which can so easily be hypocritical. So our true unspoken thoughts and not unknown to the mind which is God, because it's this mind that initiates them anyway. And here we have our first synonymous term in the chapter, God as divine mind. Well, clearly our unspoken thoughts are the same, aren't they, as our innermost desires. And it's in these innermost heartfelt desires that our real prayer lies. Desire is prayer, line 11. The implication is that inasmuch as they are spiritually based, they originate in and are known to God as infinite mind. So we are bidden to trust our desires to our real God mind as being where they effectively originate, or which is really their divine source. In other words, we cease to believe that they're our own human thinking, originating in a so-called human mind. Because when we cease to do this, then the mind which is God molds them and exalts them divinely before they take form humanly, tangibly, in words and in deeds. So do we already get a hint there of a matrix at work? In fact, the holy four-square matrix city typified, we know now, by the textbook as a whole, and found in the end to be the mother of us all, as Paul describes it in Galatians chapter 4. Because this is what it's all about, isn't it? Science and health, moulding, birthing our identity, step by step, in the image and likeness of God. And do we also see that in this case, as in that first apocalypse section, we've already got our right foot, our dominant power, our God as source power on the sea of elementary latent error, and our left foot, our secondary power, our man as manifestation power on the earth, on visible error and audible sin. No visible error, no audible sin when our words and deeds originate in God as their source and not in us humanly. In other words, what comes forth as the counter to visible error and audible sin are the words, audible, and the deeds, visible, that take form humanly, having first been moulded divinely by the mind which is God. Well, these then are the opening bars of this great symphonic structure of ideas, which is the Christian Science textbook, and specifically, they're the opening bars of the first chapter prayer. So over the page to what it is that must be found motivating our desires. And we see on line 5 that this has to be a hungering after righteousness, a hungering after all that is right, all that is upright, all that is God-like. Because when this is so, our motives are blessed of our Father and do not return to us void. As Jesus implied, everything real comes from God and returns to God. And in the case of man as God's reflection, everything real that comes from man returns to man blessed by God, full and overflowing instead of void. So we can see that what we are doing in order to satisfy our spiritual hunger is to eat up the little book. Because when we allow its teachings to come forth out of the depths of the book itself, this is the same as its coming forth from God. Remember Mrs. Eddy's words regarding the Christian Science textbook. It is the voice of your Father speaking to you. Now, incidentally, the word motive is from the same root as the verb to move. And therefore, in the paragraph starting line 8, because God is unchanging wisdom and love, who has already bestowed all good, and therefore as the all-loving, already knows all there is to know about us. He's not moved by any motives on our part, however worthy we might think they are. And it's good to notice, isn't it, how this word already occurs some 5 times on these 2 pages, 2 and 3. Very significant, isn't it, showing us what the real basis of our prayer is, acknowledging what is already done. So here we've got our second synonymous term in the chapter, love, and it's used in conjunction with the word wisdom. It's the term right at the other end of the scale from mind, isn't it? Which is the first term we're given back there on page 1. And therefore it's as if right at the beginning the text is indicating the completeness of the sevenfold range from mind to love. And therefore what we are bidden to realize is that from the beginning everything is already done. All good is already bestowed. In other words, the end, the fulfillment of the entire divine purpose, already is from the beginning. And to accept that this is so is apparently what is meant by the term wisdom, unchanging wisdom and love, the end known from, present at the beginning. You see, we'll never really understand what mind means as the source of all good until we realize that mind is love. The first 2 synonyms in the chapter, therefore. And now, very significantly, on line 15, the chapter's first reference to the term science. Not divine science, not Christian science, but the eternally changeless science of being. Spelt, as is usual, with a little b, and signifying, therefore, the changeless, timeless science of our man's being. You see, if we're told about the end of everything, everything already fulfilled in love at the point of its origin or beginning in mind, this is what constitutes the science of being. Not the science of going to be or used to be, but the science of what is actually being, changelessly permanently now. Deity unchangeable, says the marginal heading. And so our need, humanly, is to be brought into harmony with this science of our own being. Because this is indeed what truth is, line 17. The quality of goodness in us which derives from that bestowal of all good, up there on line 10, attains the demonstration of truth itself as the science of what everything is being. Which is all completely different, isn't it, from our thinking that we have to plead with God as a humanly circumscribed human being. Line 20. Nothing limited or circumscribed about the science of our man's being is there. Now in the paragraph starting line 23, a repeat of the two terms love and mind. Nothing can ever be more than love, which because it is mind, already comprehends infinity as constituting its own fully formed, fully informed intelligence. Perfect love, which alone is intelligence, is that with which mind is fully informed and which it fully comprehends. So the love which is mind and the mind which is love, the simultaneous beginning and end of the science of what God is forever being, is thus the open fount, the outpouring source, the uncircumscribed bestowal of all that we are bidden to accept, namely the truth about our own existence and blessedness, line 29. And therefore, how vainly repetitive it would be if we were to ask God to be God. In the science of his being, everything about him is changelessly the same yesterday and today and forever. Therefore, at the top of page 3, how crazy it would be to remind him to be right and to do right when this is what he already is being and is doing. In fact, this immutable rightness or righteousness is the very thing, back there on page 2, which we ourselves are hungering for, and which causes us to begin to eat up the little book. So now that wonderful paragraph starting page 3, line 4, on the spiritual mathematics. What we are engaged with in the science of being, we now see, is symbolized for us by the unerring science of mathematics, whose work obviously is already done, and whose rule of procedure obviously is already established. The principle of all goodness, line 8, having already bestowed all good operates infallibly on man's behalf, just as does the principle of mathematics. What we have to avail ourselves, therefore, is the fact that the work of divine principle is already done, line 9, and to work out our own salvation through the use of this most basic rule. Just as we do, symbolically, when we obey the rule of mathematics. In other words, as man, we reflect what God has already done. Reflect in the science of our being what God is already and is now being. That's to say, line 12, we reflect the divine being, capital D, capital B, instead of being, back there on page 2, an uncapitalized, humanly circumscribed human being. Do we see that? Then, of course, we are this divine being's image and likeness, the image and likeness of the one altogether lovely. Reflecting the already done work of eternity, but realizing that in order to reflect this demands of us absolute consecration of thought, energy, and desire. In which case, coming down to line 17, our conceptions of deity are certainly not empty. Rather, are they filled by reflection with what already is. And what is this? It's the infinitude of good, the omnipotent, omnipresent information regarding God, which infinite mind, the principle of all goodness up there on line 8, is itself already filled with. Coming down page 3, we see that the fact of this infinitely self-informed mind is the very principle of our man's being, who ceaselessly outpouring benefactions are not only already bestowed, but in the forever science of our being are necessarily already received and accepted. And how essential it is to be grateful that this is so. Because to be grateful for what we have already received in this way is to fit ourselves to go on receiving more and more good, more and more God, more and more of what God is. So what really is the nature of this already bestowed, already received, beneficent good for which it's imperative for us to be grateful? It is on line 27, infinite life, truth, and love. The first time in the book we find these three terms used in combination with one another in this particular order and in this way. Because we know, don't we, that as we go on, the text will literally teem with references to these three terms. So clearly they're of very great significance and importance. It's because they define for us the absolute reality of our real God being, and therefore are what we have to be grateful for primarily, for then we won't be hypocritical in thanking God for all the merely human blessings that can be said to be added to us secondly. It's when we are not grateful for life, truth, and love, at the top of page 4, our lives become barren. Why? Because, says the text, our heart in this case is far from divine truth and love. And here again our first reference to the idea of heart, which, as we remember, recurs again and again throughout the chapter, doesn't it? All our endeavors must be heartfelt, mustn't they? Until at last in the sanctuary, that's over on page 15, we've entered what is called the heart of prayer itself. It seems already, therefore, that this combination of the two terms, truth and love, Remember our two foundations in the Apocalypse's opening section? These two terms, truth and love, lie at the heart of the whole vast subject of Christian Science, signifying what our life actually consists of divinely, and ensuring humanly that our lives are not spiritually barren but fruitful. As we go on, this will be confirmed more and more and more. Because now it is that in the paragraph starting 4:3, we keep the commandments of our Master in our daily lives, which in consequence are spiritually fruitful, full of heartfelt gratitude for all that he has done. In other words, they are full of grace, patience, meekness, love, good deeds, and so on. And what is it that Jesus, our Master, has done? Well, he's proved humanly that now and forever, God's work is already done. And that this perfect work is perfect man. That's what he's proved. So the keynote undoubtedly is love. If ye love me, keep my commandments. And because when in this way we live lives of love, little l, this attests our worthiness, line 15, to be partakers of God's outpouring love, capital L. So we begin to pray without ceasing, to fervently desire to be always good, to be always like God. God is all, there's really nothing else for us to be, is there, but what God is. But it won't happen unless we first long to be better and holier, line 18, and express this longing in daily watchfulness and in striving to assimilate more of the divine character. Remember, take, eat, this is my body. Take the little book, take it and assimilate it. Take it and eat it up. Because it's this which will take our characters and mold and fashion them anew until we awake in the likeness of the divine character. Do we feel a matrix still at work, just as we had it on page 1, molding and exalting our unspoken desires so that they take form in words and deeds? And all for the purpose of our reaching on 4:23 the science of Christianity through demonstration of the divine nature. So notice how the previous reference to the science of being has become now the science of Christianity. The science, that's to say, whereby we live and embody all these essential God qualities in order as man to be his body. Otherwise it can't be done. Making long audible prayers, materializing worship in whatever form is really useless. But what, on the other hand, is being discussed here, as page 4 comes to an end, are the actual works of spiritual understanding, line 27, which cause us to be born again, or which regenerate us. Do you see that there? can we feel then with these first four pages that the accent is on the prayer itself of spiritual understanding and unself-love. Because now as we come to the top of page 5, we begin to learn how this prayer of an absolute faith that all things are possible to God, firstly reforms, regenerates the sinner. And this will go on until the bottom of page 11. So, sorrow for sin in the marginal heading, paving the way for the sinner's reformation, or for when sin is no more. And this means that what is at work basically is what is meant by the capitalized term Christ, as we find it there on lines 15, 24, and 29. The second term in the order of the four, the word Christ, Christianity, science, isn't it? When, therefore, for the purpose of destroying sin, we drink the cup of Christ, line 15, and ingratitude and persecution seems to fill it to the brim. This is really, says the text, God pouring the riches of his love into the understanding and affections, all because of our need of being saved from sin. Real cup, the real receptacle, therefore, is the cup of understanding and affection. And that which fills it is the riches of God's love, strengthening us according to our need, even if this means sin having to be destroyed through suffering. So what is sin? Sin is any measure of being apparently cut off from God, of not being in communion with God, and therefore of being something other than God. Christ, on the other hand, which Jesus knew to be his only real identity and therefore which constituted him the Son of God, line 29, is that which is never cut off from God and therefore is totally sinless. And it's this which is shown forth humanly, of course, in the sinless character and works of Jesus, which must little by little become more and more the case with each one of us. And therefore it is that Christ destroys the works of the devil, as being the opposite, of course, of the works of God. And therefore what we have to be is the works of God and not the works of the devil. Because only then is sin forgiven, line 23, destroyed by Christ, truth and life. The two terms truth and life used here to define what Christ is as the destroyer and forgiver of sin. Why? Well, Christ, of course, is truth in its inseparable, unfragmentable wholeness, which in forgiving the sin of being supposedly cut off from God destroys sin, and therefore is of the nature of deathless, indestructible life. Christ, truth and life, in this particular text. Now, because of this true sense of forgiveness, it's basically love, of course, line 3, that's at work. Love correcting, love reforming, and therefore love governing man. And so the terms truth and life, back there on page 5, lead to the term love. Truth, life, love. All relating to the reforming, healing Christ. And so as we come down that page, we see that love is the impersonal principle of being, 9:16, which alone reforms the sinner, because it shows us that we can never be cut off from God. Therefore, of course, that there really is no such thing as sin needing to be forgiven. Nevertheless, because of the virulent claim of sin, Jesus had to uncover it and rebuke it severely before he cast it out. Even Peter, who wanted him not to have to go through the experience of proving the nothingness of sin and death on the cross, Jesus said of him that he was an offense unto him. So his rebuke was said to be fearful. Yet, it was all the work of divine love, more than which we cannot ask, higher we cannot look, further we cannot go. That's page 6, line 17. So says the text in our prayers, the great thing is to understand and not misunderstand love. Otherwise, prayer can become hypocritical, a safety valve for wrongdoing. Which means that what we have to avoid, and this is the second paragraph on page 7, is deceptively impressive verbal and audible prayer. Because this can embrace too much love of applause to induce and encourage Christian sentiment.